Content warning, this episode contains discussion of murder and sexual violence.
Willie Manning has been convicted and sentenced to death in Mississippi twice for two separate double homicides. But from there, things got complicated pretty quickly.
There were substantial evidentiary issues with one of the convictions. Manning's attorneys were able to get it thrown out, and the state dropped those charges.
The other conviction still stands, though, and the state still wants to execute Manning. But there were problems with this case, too. Years after the conviction, the Justice Department and the FBI sent prosecutors a letter about the testimony given at the trial by their scientific experts. They said that the testimony had gone too far, that it had, quote, exceeded the limits of science and were therefore invalid.
But again, the conviction still stands, and the state of Mississippi still wants to execute Manning.
So what exactly is going on here? To help us try to figure it out, we spoke with some attorneys from the Mississippi Office of Capital Post-Conviction Counsel who are working on Manning's case. We also reached out to the state attorney general and did not receive a response. The defense attorneys we spoke with will discuss the details of both of Manning's cases, why exactly he was convicted, what they see as the problems with those convictions, and what exactly they think should happen next.
My name is Anya Kane. I'm a journalist.
And I'm Kevin Greenlee. I'm an attorney.
And this is The Murder Sheet.
We're a true crime podcast focused on original reporting, interviews, and deep dives into murder cases.
We're The Murder Sheet.
And this is The Murder Cases of Willie Manning. Is Mississippi about to execute an innocent man? Let's start with a really easy one. Can you guys all introduce yourselves?
I'm David Voitson. I'm an attorney now in Louisiana, but I've been representing Willie Manning since around 2000.
I'm Rob Meek. I'm in Jackson, Mississippi. I was first appointed to represent Mr. Manning in about 2000, and I have not represented him for the entire period from 2020 to 2000 to the present. But I do represent him now and have for the past 10 or 12 years.
Hey, I'm Chrissy Noble. I'm the current director of the Mississippi Office of Capital Post-Conviction Counsel. And we started working with David and Rob in Manning's case about a little over a year ago. So I've only been in for about a year to a year and a half.
You mentioned you're the director of the Mississippi Office of Capital Post-Conviction Counsel. So here's a very basic question. What is that? What kind of work does it do? And why is it important?
Yeah, so our office, we represent at one time or another, unless there's a conflict, pretty much everyone on death row, if they are indigent, which they all currently are, in their post-conviction proceedings. So that's after trial, after direct appeal, comes the post-conviction arena. And so it's a little bit different than what you normally hear about, maybe on TV or TV series about an appeal where you're going up and you're just reviewing kind of law that was made in the trial court. In post-conviction, you're allowed to bring in new facts, things that weren't discovered. If there's something like, you know, what we commonly refer to as junk science, that can come in post-conviction as well. So that's basically what it is. As to why it's important, I think probably everyone on here can attest to the fact that trial in general is, I mean, our criminal justice system is a human system, so there's going to be inherent errors in it. And post-conviction allows you to bring and point out those errors to the court as you As they develop, as they progress, as science develops, and that's key, especially, you know, we're talking about, you know, Willie Manning in this case for some type of actual innocence case as well. You usually see those in post-conviction as well.
I want to ask about Willie Manning. This, of course, is the man who was convicted of two separate double homicides that would have taken place within a relatively brief period of time. Looking at the second case first, what can you tell us about the double homicide of Emmeline Jimerson and her 60-year-old daughter, Albertha Jordan?
Yeah, that happened on Martin Luther King Day of 1993. To give you the timing sequence, the murders of the students in Mr. Manning's other case happened in December of 1992, so they're like 5 weeks apart. But the elderly women, Ms. Jordan and Jimerson, they live in a housing project at Starkville, and they were a mother and daughter, and they were found dead in their apartment that stabbed and beaten. And the case went unsolved for quite a while, and immediately after, you know, discovering the bodies, the Starkville Police Department did a canvass of the neighborhood. They went door to door to all the apartments to see if anybody saw anything suspicious. So there were a few things, but they never made an arrest. And then sometime later, they picked up Mr. Manning. And the key evidence against him was the testimony of this man by the name of Kevin Lucius. Now, the story just, they didn't, in fact, they didn't have any, like, DNA or fiber or fingerprints or anything like that. Mr. Lucius told law enforcement that he had been talking to Manning, and Manning admit, you know, said he needed money, and then Lucius said he went back to his own apartment, which was across the street from where the victims live, and he saw Manning knock on their door, then push his way in. And then he just didn't see Manning come out. And then he went to the back to talk to his girlfriend. And he said he lived there with his girlfriend and their newborn. So that was Lucius's trial testimony. And it was largely on the basis of that, that Mr. Manning was convicted of this murder. And it seemed a pretty tight case. They saw, Lucius said he saw Manning push his way into it. So when we were doing the post-conviction investigation, by this time, Lucius was in Missouri. He was serving a life sentence on completely unrelated murder charges. So we did find his girlfriend, who was still in Starkville, and she told us that it was all false because they didn't even move into that apartment until 2 weeks after the murders took place. The murders took place around January 18th or so, and they did not move in until February 1st. So we also subpoenaed the records from that housing complex. And sure enough, the lease that we found had her name February 1st, and the utilities were turned on February 1st. And we also, through discovery, through the Starkville Police Department, we found copies of the cards where they wrote down the results of their neighborhood canvas. And on that apartment, it was listed as vacant. And we went to the trial attorneys and said, did you see this? And he said, absolutely not. I would definitely abuse that. So that was never turned over to the defense. So, there would have been evidence that clearly would have shown that Lucius was lying. And, you know, we spoke to Lucius, and he came down to the hearing and admitted that his testimony was a lie, that he was feeling some pressure from law enforcement, and he was being told that his girlfriend might be arrested for withholding evidence. And she told us that, you know, they were threatening her and at the same time offering her some money, you know, not a whole lot, but like $20 here and there. But she didn't testify against him. So all this came out at the post-conviction hearing. The other thing that came out, too, at trial, there was testimony about a bloody footprint that was found near the victim's body. At trial, the crime scene examiner says, well, they saw the bloody print, but they couldn't really do anything else with it. But in the paperwork and files from the crime lab that we obtained at post-conviction, there were measurements taken, and it showed that whoever made the footprint had a size 8 shoe, and Mr. Manning's shoe size was about 11, so we were able to show that. So all that put together, we ended up getting his conviction thrown out, and then the prosecutor declined to try him again, so he was exonerated for that crime. As far as we know, no one's been arrested since, gone unsolved. That's kind of the story.
I'm sure this must be a naive question, but of course, first of all, not only was he convicted, he was sentenced to death. How can a person be convicted and sentenced to death based on such a flawed witness and problematic evidence? How's that even happen?
Well, at the time, nobody knew he was a flawed witness, you know. He testifies, and there was nothing to cross-examine him with. Nothing like a lease to confront him with. And so without that, there was no reason to find his girlfriend, to put her on the stand, nothing like that. And so, you know, the jury makes this decision, you know, based on only on what it hears. The jury doesn't know everything we learn after the fact. So that's probably why. And the tale that told the trial was probably a compelling one to them. It just wasn't the truth.
My next question would be, is it unusual for a person on death row to be exonerated?
I wouldn't say it's unusual. It happens a lot more than maybe people think, especially in Mississippi. We've had a number of exonerations on death row. In a lot of those cases, DNA evidence and an attack on what is now known to be flawed forensic science led the way. You know, Kennedy Brewer was on death row, so was Sherwood Brown and Eddie Lee Howard, but they've been exonerated in the last about 10 years. Going back before that, Sabrina Butler's been exonerated. LaVon Brooks was serving a life sentence, and he was part of Kennedy Brewer's. He was convicted of the same flawed evidence that Kennedy Brewer was, and he's been exonerated. So it happens, you know, in a shocking amount of times. And it happened, you know, here. Yeah, and I was going to say, it's, and some people might say, well, what about other evidence? But it's not unusual at all for there to be some circumstantial evidence that might indicate guilt. I mean, there was an older case from the 70s. Probably the lead defendant was Larry Ruffin. He and two others were convicted. They weren't sentenced to death, but it was for, you know, rape, murder. And they gave confessions, but DNA later exonerated them. Even cases that seem pretty strong at trial, they should be shown through, you know, subsequent investigation to be deeply flawed.
I agree with David that it's not unusual in at all. It does happen. It should be shocking how often it happens. I would add how hard it is to get someone exonerated, especially in Mississippi, and how many years it takes to do that. And it takes, you know, tireless efforts like David with Manning, who's been on there for 20 years. And I always think about like the bigger picture of, you know, just capital cases that are worked on long time by really good attorneys that are being overturned, tossed out, exonerated, and how many more people in the criminal justice system just don't have those attorneys. But it's unfortunately not unusual.
In another case I should mention is Curtis Flowers, who had received a lot of attention a couple of years ago because the U.S. Supreme Court reversed his conviction due to racial discrimination in jury selection, and then the attorney general opted not to retry him, even though he'd faced trial six times before.
You longtime listeners know we love two things, mysteries and June's Journey.
Say bon voyage to the everyday when you play this free-to-download hidden object game. June's Journey is the ultimate escape with a wonderful mystery storyline.
This game will take you all around the world to unravel mysteries and sort out clues in classic 1920s locales. It will sharpen your observational skills to boot, as you'll have to pick out hidden objects out of each scene to advance.
You play as June Parker, a whip-smart, headstrong sleuth who can't seem to help getting embroiled in all matter of mysteries. It's like becoming the central figure in your own cozy mystery story.
Seriously, download this game and enjoy. It's like a built-in work break and gives me a feeling of being decompressed and ready to tackle whatever's next.
I'll play anywhere at any time. It's a fun activity to do before going to bed or even just after waking up. It's great to play while sitting around waiting for a source to call back. It's a really nice mood booster that encourages me to take breaks during the day.
June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
On the same charges.
Absolutely. Based on all of this, I'd love to get each of your opinions. Just in your personal view, do you think that it is too easy for people to be sentenced to death, given all of this about people getting exonerated off of death row?
Yes, it is too easy.
Right. I mean, there's often an inadequate time and resources. I mean, this, you know, Mr. Manning's case is a clear example. Mr. Manning was represented at trial by Mark Williamson, who was in private practice in Starkville. He was, you know, just a fairly young lawyer at the time, and he was given almost no money for an investigator, like, I'm saying like about $1,000, if that much. That's how bad it was. And he realized, you know, that the case had gone unsolved for so long, and there were dozens of potential alibi witnesses, character witnesses, mitigation witnesses, forensic issues, all sorts of stuff. And he was trying to do all of this for a man he believed was innocent. And at the same time, you know, he had a mortgage to pay, so he had to attend to his other cases. And so it puts him in a horrible position. And that happens a lot of times. And then here, and here's the, you know, a commonality in both of Mr. Manning's cases, is that both cases went unsolved for a long time. And as a result, you know, there's great pressure to make an arrest, to do something on the case. And what happens is it seems that the law enforcement ended up relying on, you know, very incentivized witnesses in, you know, the case involving Ms. Jimerson and Jordan. The state turned to Kevin Lucius, who was looking out for Lucius. He didn't really care about Manning. And so he made stuff up. And that sort of stuff happens. You know, there's a lot of people who are in jail have a lot of incentive to cooperate with the state because they're facing, you know, substantial charges, whether, you know, pretty serious felony charges themselves. And if they could avoid doing a long sentence, there's a lot of pressure to do that.
Yeah, I'm hearing you out. I mean, you did have desperate witnesses who were highly incentivized, which happens in many, many cases. Here's a pretty good example of witnesses that received not just help with their own cases, but also, you know, sums of money. And on top of that, you have evidence being suppressed. I mean, this isn't the only case that happens in. This is just a clear example of it.
Now, unlike most people who get exonerated, Manning not only stayed in prison, but he actually remained on death row because he was, of course, convicted and sentenced to death for another double homicide. What can you tell us about the murders of John Steckler and Tiffany Miller?
This was always, you know, a very troubling case. Just from the get-go, just reading the transcript, I'll just kind of relate the facts. As I understood the state's theory to be, John and Tiffany were at John's fraternity house on the Mississippi State University campus, and they went out to Tiffany's car. They were going to drive off. And they allegedly came upon Willie Manning breaking into someone else's car. Manning was taking a number of items from his car, gathered them up, and then took John and Tiffany at gunpoint, put them into her car, where he made John drive while Tiffany sat on his lap. She was just a two-seater car. It was a old Toyota MR7. And they drove out to this deserted dirt road where both were shot and John was run over by the car. And again, continuing with the state's theory, you know, Manning drove to this nearby apartment complex where he left Tiffany's car, still gathering, you know, carrying all the stolen goods, and somehow got to his house, which was miles out of town. That was really... It's just hard to kind of wrap your head around that actually happening. But that was their theory. they found there was a token from a restroom at a gas station in North Mississippi that was found at the murder scene. And the person whose car was broken into recognized that token. And that's why they linked the two. They said, that's why, you know, whoever did the car burglary must have then kidnapped the victim. Although they didn't really have any clear evidence that actual kidnapping took place. That was kind of their general theory about it. But, evidence, it was another story. And, you know, the key evidence against Mr. Manning came from this guy, Earl Jordan, who said that Manning confessed to him, that Manning said that he and this other guy, Jesse Lawrence, did the kidnapping and murder. So in Jordan's account, four people were in this two-seater car, and all this sort of happened. But give you a little bit of background about Jordan. He was facing possible indictment as a habitual offender. Some of his crimes were breaking in, committing burglaries on the Mississippi State campus. And in fact, he was an early suspect in this case. He, in his initial interviews, he identified someone else, this other person, Anthony Reed, and said that he had seen Reed drive around with Tiffany. Now, apparently the sheriff didn't believe any of that. And Jordan was kind of let go. But then eventually Jordan found himself in jail, found himself in a cell with Willie Manning. And then Jordan suddenly hears this confession. Coincidentally, he was never indicted as a habitual offender. He was indicted merely for looting. At trial, Jordan denied having a deal. He said he was hoping he would get some benefit from it. And the prosecutor strenuously argued that Jordan had absolutely nothing to gain from coming forward, that he had everything to lose. In 2023, Jordan finally signed an affidavit admitting that he testified falsely, that the sheriff had made it clear to him, not in writing, but just had a way of making it clear that he would take care of him, and that time was running out. He had to do something with the clear implication that he would be getting some kind of help on his own charges. And so Jordan said he made the statement against Manning. And so that turned out to be just a key part of the state's case.
And of course, there were also some issues of fairness of the process that arose even before the trial itself actually began. Manning, of course, is an African-American male, and it was reported that some African-American potential jurors were excluded because they read African-American magazines, which were allegedly a sign of liberalism. I'm curious. So do racial matters play a role in some of these cases?
I think so. Yeah, I think they struck almost all the black jurors. I don't remember if there's even a single black person left in the jury. I just don't recall. But one of the things, this was tried around when O.J. Simpson was in the news a lot. And the prosecutor, when he struck jurors for their reading material, he says, and some of these jurors are reading publications that espouse Manning, I mean, O.J. Simpson's innocence. And so I looked on the questionnaire to see what these incendiary publications were, and turned out to be like Jet and Ebony magazine. And so I went and looked at all the issues of Jet and Ebony from the time of O.J. Simpson's arrest to his trial. And there was never an article that espoused his innocence. He was covered a lot, sometimes it was just factual crime reporting. Sometimes it was about in the context of domestic violence and things like that. There was never a position, about Simpson certainly being innocent. So this was made up based on racial stereotypes.
And then in terms of, like, we've talked about how the problems with some of the witnesses against Manning in this situation and what they claimed or what Jordan claimed. And I guess in at this time, if you could underscore how important that was in terms of, getting the original conviction for Manning and why we should be certainly paying attention now that he says that he was lying.
Yeah, well, I mean, Jordan just scratches the surface, actually, the misconduct in this case. I mean, Jordan's big now because he only signed an affidavit last year. Before that, he was afraid of the sheriff. He had mentioned it to me in 2013, but he wouldn't put his name on a sworn affidavit. But he's done that now. But even, before Jordan came along, we looked at, Mr. Manning's ex-girlfriend, woman Paula Hathorn. She had like over 50 bad check charges pending against her. And they went away too. And she got a big, like a Crime Stoppers reward. And we also found that this was a clear, Brady violation, or exculpatory evidence that was not disclosed. The sheriff asked Hathorn to allow him to record her conversation with Manning while Manning was in the jail. And the point was for her to try to elicit an incriminating statement from him. But in the process, as she's talking, she says all sorts of things that contradict her trial testimony. Like talking about how she's being threatened with being charged with accessory after the fact and any number of things. None of that was disclosed until we did the investigation for the initial post-conviction petition. And that's what we also found out, just how beneficial cooperating was to her in terms of how much time she was going to serve. So that came out. There was another guy, Frank Parker, who testified against Mr. Manning. Parker is a really interesting person. He is from Texas, and he happened to be in Starkville and was arrested. And he testified that he overheard Manning talking to this other inmate named Miami. And in it, Manning was talking about how he disposed of the murder weapon. Parker has said he was not facing serious charges in Texas. It was basically a technicality and made it seem like he was doing all of this out of the kindness of his heart, being a good citizen. But, his court records from San Antonio prove otherwise. He was facing serious time for burglary. His own uncle, who was former law enforcement, gave an affidavit saying, if Frank told him good morning, he wouldn't believe it because Frank's a liar. In fact, he had to padlock, rooms in the house because of the FU would break in and steal things. And then recently last year, Chrissy finally found Miami. His real name's Henry Richardson, and we were just never able to find him before. But she found him. He was in prison in Florida, and he gave a sworn affidavit saying that conversation never happened. He just didn't talk about to other people about their crimes. It just didn't happen. So that goes by the wayside. So everything about the state's case has been crumbling over the years. There's one other thing. I don't know if this is necessarily all, interesting. It might be a little technical, but, after we had the state court hearing about the recorded conversations with Paula Hathorn in that. We lost in state court, and this is when Rob got back on the case. We went into federal court, and we thought we had a super strong case, in part because of discrimination and jury selection and all this other stuff. But as an example of just how horribly unfair that the process can be, the federal court, Court of Appeals in New Orleans said that Mr. Manning's federal case was out of time. And how that came to be is really kind of shocking. Immediately after his first appeal, after the trial, you have an appeal. This is before the post-conviction process begins. The trial court appointed a local attorney to represent Manning in post-conviction. That lawyer moved to get off. And a very experienced lawyer asked to be appointed. Time went by, and finally the local judge ignored the qualified lawyer's request to be appointed and appointed another local attorney. Immediately filed a motion to get off saying, I don't know this stuff. I shouldn't be representing him. And by the time all of that cleared up, the time to the statute of limitations to file in federal court expired through no fault of his own. And so even before I moved to Mississippi to take his case, his federal time had expired. And we tried to get equitable tolling, saying this is pretty extraordinary. If a state court twice appoints lawyers to do a job, but those lawyers say, no, I'm not qualified to do it, and the time expires to file, how can this be fair? You have to have some kind of equitable consideration. And the court says, yeah, this was pretty extraordinary, but Manning didn't do enough himself. It's like, you know, Manning's big sin was that he was relying on the state to be true to its word to appoint qualified lawyers. And he was, you know, he had every reason to expect that, but it didn't happen. And he paid the price. He didn't get federal review. And so all of the claims we had developed before then, you know, were not heard in federal court. When we came to 2013, when we sought DNA testing, and this is also when the FBI got involved on some of the forensic issues in the case.
And we'll just add one point that David touched on about Earl Thornton and some others. You know, Earl did tell us and put in his affidavit the reason he didn't sign an affidavit previously was because of his fear of the sheriff. That time-wise lines up. When the case was previously going on, the sheriff there was a longtime sheriff. He had been sheriff for like 25 years. He was powerful in the area. When Earl finally came forward last year, that sheriff is no longer in office. And in fact, the district attorney who was at the time, who was also a long-term district attorney, also not in office. And it wasn't just Earl Thornton that we were hearing that from. Some others that signed affidavits said very similar things to us. So it does, if there was a question about like why now for Earl Thornton, it does make a lot of sense.
Absolutely. Jumping into some of the forensics on this, what can you tell us about the hair evidence in this case?
Yeah, the law enforcement did they processed the scene, especially the car, Tiffany's car, especially since, according to the state's theory, the perpetrator would have been in that car, both riding to the murder scene and then away from it. And they found some hairs, and they sent it off to the FBI for examination. And they didn't do DNA testing on the hairs, but an FBI expert said he couldn't match the hairs to anyone, but they were from an African American. And those hairs were admitted into evidence, and then in the trial, the prosecutor relied on the hairs, saying they came from an African American. Look at the defendant, he's an African American. As just part of the whole chain of evidence in the state's theory, in the state's reckoning. In 2013, the FBI was doing a re-examination of forensic practices, and it issued a letter saying that it's beyond the capacity of science to identify the race of someone by the hair. You know, that just doesn't happen. And the expert should never have testified about that hair. So that we thought that would help us to get DNA testing. And we've been trying to get DNA testing. The court granted us DNA testing, and we selected a lab with the state, and the lab looked at the hairs. And it's a good lab, it was a reputable lab, a lot of people use it, but they said that our samples, they could not develop DNA profiles from the hairs, saying that these samples must have been too old, too degraded, or too small for them. And so we found another lab that specialized in old, small, degraded samples that had better capacity. When we first did this, we had no idea. And the lab itself had no idea whether they can develop the profile or not until they actually try. And so we said, look, let's send it to the specialized lab, which has a success rate of like 90%. And the court says, no, you've had your chance at DNA testing. In any event, there's a lot of other evidence to support Manning's conviction. And they pointed to the Jordan confession, and they pointed to some ballistics evidence, which is the other forensic piece.
Tell us about the ballistics evidence.
Yeah, well, the background of the ballistics evidence is that, you know, the state decided to, well, they never recovered the gun, let me just say that. And they went to Manning's house, and they discovered that some bullets were in a tree where somebody had been firing a gun at a tree. So they dug these bullets out, and they let state's expert compare those bullets to the bullets found victims. And he said that the bullets gave the same gun to the exclusion of every gun in the world. And the FBI in 2013 sent out a letter to all the parties saying science can't support that. You cannot say that. And we had experts in 2013 to look at that, and the court did not buy it at the time. But Chrissy knows more about this because she's been working with our expert a bit more. But apparently, science has continued to investigate this over the last 10 years, and they've drawn some important conclusions. Namely, you can't make these comparisons at all. Is that right, Chrissy?
That's right. So our expert kind of looked at these reports that led to the what I'll call the Manning letter in 2013 by like the National Academy of Science, as he called them, was the first crack in the dam for this type of ballistics evidence, which back then was really kind of thought of as like a fingerprint, like this gun or this bullet matches that bullet, or casing matches the gun to the exclusion of everything. Like that sounds very fingerprint-like, and the Mississippi Supreme Court, you know, has even labeled that in Manning's case their damning evidence. And so in 2013, you have like, well, you can't say that to that amount of certitude. Since then, you have additional reports, like you've had something called like the PCAST. It's like a presidential counsel report that came out and said, it's not just that you can't say it to 100% certitude, it's that you shouldn't be saying this to any degree of certitude. So basically what you can say is that, you know, think about a Ruger, that this kind of bullet came from this Ruger, but not from this particular Ruger. And so science has continued to develop since 2013. Our expert, who is a former FBI officer, you know, calls it kind of like a bigger, quote unquote, paradigm shift since 2013 till now. And you see courts across the country excluding firearms testimony, like the type, especially like the type that was given in Manning. So not just they're taking the stand and saying, well, maybe not 100% certitude, but maybe 99. A lot of times they can't take the stand at all. And if they do take the stand, they're limited very much so on what they can say. And so now that evidence that the Mississippi Supreme Court relied on so heavily as like their words, damning evidence, it's not there anymore. It is false evidence.
And just to clarify for some of our listeners who may not be so familiar with ballistics and firearms, that's the type of ballistics evidence where, like, basically this bullet came from this gun because of these markings on it. Is that right?
Right.
That's right. That there are unique markings, you know, to the exclusion of all other guns and bullets in the world. And that is false evidence. Fortunately, the FBI came forward in 2013, and now you just have, you know, a more of the paradigm shift showing that.
So I guess the obvious question is, how can a conviction stand or be defended if it's based on expert testimony that the Justice Department has said in writing that they no longer stand behind?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. If you look at the state's response now, it's mostly too late, or where it's already looked at some ballistics evidence. It's already seen it once in 2013, never mind any advances in the science since then. So there has to be finality. Let's have the case draw to a close. They don't really want to look at the evidence itself and say, okay, right now, how does this conviction stand? How does it line up? We know there was no confession of Earl Jordan. You know, we know there was no confession confession in the presence of, you know, Frank Parker, other evidence was shaded by witnesses who were had every incentive to shade their testimony to the state. You know, we know that the ballistics adds nothing to the case. What do you have? There's nothing. It's just some very strange, unusual fact pattern that no one satisfactorily explained.
So given the problems you've identified with the witness testimony, given the problems with the hair and the ballistics evidence, what remedy do you all feel would be appropriate for Manning in this situation?
At a minimum, he should be given a hearing where he has an opportunity to present this evidence to a judge so he could hear it and decide the merits of the case. I think there's more than enough to support that. And that's you know, what should happen in cases when a prisoner presents allegations supported with sworn testimony, affidavits showing that there's been an injustice. There should be an opportunity to present that in court and have a judge decide it.
In our view, the state seems to be pressing to set an execution date in Manning's case, you know, and that's even before some of these issues have been fully litigated. Why do you imagine they're doing that? And what is your response to it?
Our response is that it's premature, to say the least, that this new evidence has come to light. And by law, it should be considered. I mean, the state takes this position that there should be no right to have a second bite at the apple. Like, if you come up with new evidence, that it's too late. You've had your one shot. You lost. Go away. It's time to carry out the judgment. But fortunately, the law actually provides otherwise. It does provide a vehicle for cases exactly like this. If you come up with new evidence, you know, the courthouse doors need to remain open for cases with great miscarriages of justice.
Now, what's currently happening in the case? What sort of development should people be looking for?
Well, we've filed our papers, and I think all the briefing's been done for now, and so it's just a matter of, you know, waiting for the court before their ruling.
Do you feel like the Manning cases, I guess, plural, are an anomaly in our justice system, or do you think that they speak to systemic issues that face a lot of different cases?
I think they have, you know, systematic problems. There's a great tragedy of cases relying on dubious forensic testimony and also highly incentivized witnesses. I mean, jailhouse informants are a big, big problem. And it's because, you know, they're facing so much time and there's so much pressure on them that, you know, you weak people are going to they're going to look out for themselves, cooperate to reduce their own charges. In a situation where you have to start relying on informants in jail, I think that should be a red flag in any case. People should proceed with great caution when they see that.
I also do not think it is an anomaly. These issues that have come up in both of the Mannings cases come up in other cases. And so while, you know, it's not shocking to see this, it is still quite appalling to see it.
How has working on cases like this affected your view of capital punishment?
I always try to tread carefully with personal views on anything, because I'm one of those people that do try very, very hard to, like, agreeably disagree with people, because they spend a lot of time, you know, formulating their opinions, and I should listen to them. So even regardless of what your views are on the death penalty, if you're going to have a death penalty, you have got to do it right. And cases like this are not done right. And again, this is not an anomaly. This is just a spotlighted example.
We'd like to sincerely thank Chrissy, David, and Rob, as well as John, for their time and insights on these cases.
Thanks so much for listening to The Murder Sheet. If you have a tip concerning one of the cases we cover, please email us at murdersheet@gmail.com. If you have actionable information about an unsolved crime, please report it to the appropriate authorities.
If you're interested in joining our Patreon, that's available at www.patreon.com/murdersheet. If you want to tip us a bit of money for records requests, you can do so at www.buymeacoffee.com/murdersheet. We very much appreciate any support.
Special thanks to Kevin Tyler Greenlee, who composed the music for the Murder Sheet, and who you can find on the web at kevintg.com.
If you're looking to talk with other listeners about a case we've covered, you can join the Murder Sheet discussion group on Facebook. We mostly focus our time on research and reporting, so we're not on social media much. We do try to check our email account, but we ask for patience as we often receive a lot of messages. Thanks again for listening.